On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Characterization, Design, Construction, and Monitoring of Bioreactor Landfills. Today's training was developed by the IPRC Alternative Landfill Technology Team. My name is Juliana Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Roxboro, North Carolina. I'm going to serve as the moderator on today's training. I'm going to cover introductory material in the next few slides, and then quickly turn the presentation over to our instructors from the ITRC Alternative Landfill Technology Team. As we go through the presentation, each of you in the audience are in control of what slide you're on. The slide number is in the upper left-hand corner, and the instructors are going to say that as we go through the slides today. If you're using the Cluin system, the series of orange buttons along the top allow you to navigate. The double left button brings you back to slide one. The single left button brings you back one slide.
Is this not a speaker?
Most often, you're going to use that third button, the single right arrow, to move forward one slide at a time through the presentation. The double right arrow fast forwards you to the last slide of the presentation. The hash button takes you back to that presentation overview page where we started today. The question mark button is there primarily for our simulcast audience. If you're in the simulcast audience and you have a question, go ahead and select that question mark button, and you can type in a question. I will see that as a moderator. So if you've just joined the conference, we are picking up background noise, especially if you are talking right now. We are picking up noise from your location. We ask that our phone line audience please put your phones on mute.
On this thing.
So I'm sorry, if you are speaking, can you please put your phone on mute? Anyone is welcome to use that question mark button at any time during today's training class. You can use that to send in a comment or a question to the moderator. For the phone line audience, you're welcome to ask your own questions out loud, but we do ask that you hold those questions until the designated question and answer sessions. We'll have one in the middle of the presentation and another at the end. As listed on the slide, today's training course is based on the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance for Characterization, Design, Construction, and Monitoring of Bioreactor Landfills. Today's training is an introduction to this document, and we do encourage you to download the document itself. If you haven't already, we'll show you a link to where you can do that at the end of today's training class. The presentation itself is also available to download. In addition to what you'll see on the slides during the training class, more information is available in the speaker's notes section of the downloaded version. Today's training is brought to you in cooperation with the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. They host the Cluin website that we're using today. Bioreactors are landfills where a controlled addition of liquid accelerates the decomposition of waste. Today's training provides information on the principles used to make decisions faced by regulatory agencies, consultants, and industry during permitting, operating, and monitoring a bioreactor landfill. If you move to slide two using that orange right arrow button, I'm going to talk very briefly about ITRC. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States. It's a network that is led by state regulators. ITRC includes all 50 states and D.C. as members. Federal partners include Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency. ITRC also includes participants from consulting firms and technology developers and other members of industry, and they join ITRC through the Industry Affiliates Program. Members also include academia and community stakeholders. This diverse group works together on a wide variety of topics that could address technologies, contaminants, or specific sites, or specific types of sites. Technical teams work together to produce documents and training. On slide three, this is our disclaimer and copyright. We include this information in all ITRC presentations and ask that you please read over this slide. In short, it says we tried to provide accurate and reliable information, but do not warranty this material. We recommend you check with local, state, federal laws, as well as experts. ITRC does not endorse any specific products. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted, so please ask permission before using. On slide four, this is a list of course topics for 2008 Internet-based training classes. More information is available on the ITRC website, and I've listed that at the top of this slide. You can go to the website and look under Internet-based training to see a schedule and also links to archives of previous ITRC training topics. On slide five, if you've joined after I've got started, please review the logistical reminders on the left of slide five. In today's presentation, we're going to start by talking about regulatory flexibility, advantages, disadvantages, the bioreactor mechanisms, and design considerations. About halfway through, we're going to have a break for questions, and we do ask that you hold all of your questions until that question and answer break. In the second half, we'll talk about construction, operation, and monitoring. At the end, we'll go to some links to additional resources, including the feedback form, and we do ask that everyone on the call today fill out the feedback form and let us know what you thought about today's training class. At the end, we hope to have more time for your questions. On slide 6, I'll introduce our instructors for today. All of our instructors are members of the ITRC Alternative Landfill Technology Team, and that team is led by Charles Johnson of the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. Mark Stierfoss is with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection, Division of Solid and Hazardous Waste. He is a case manager overseeing the remediation of landfills throughout New Jersey. He was previously a permit writer and project manager for regional solid waste landfills and has been involved in all aspects of landfill design, construction, operations, and closure activities. Michael Kukoc is a principal at Aquaterra Environmental Solutions, headquartered in Overland Park, Kansas. His technical focus has been on the development of alternative landfill covers in both wet and dry climates, phytoremediation and phytotechnology applications, as well as leachate recirculation technologies at municipal solid waste landfills. Sabette Tolomat has worked for the U.S. EPA Office of Research and Development in Cincinnati, Ohio since 2003. He leads EPA's National Research Program in the area of solid waste research. His main research areas are solid waste management, bioreactor landfills, waste containment performance, construction and demolition waste landfills, and fate and transport of environmental pollutants. Our backup instructor is Graham Zimmerman of the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality. If you move to slide 7, I will now turn over today's presentation to Mark Stierfoss of the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. Mark?
Thank you, Juliana. With my background as a regulator, we are often told not to consider the N-word when making our regulatory decisions. However, the Alternative Landfill Technologies team believes that if properly designed, constructed, and operated, bioreactor landfills have potential for making additional, money. However, money's not the only reason to pursue a bioreactor landfill, and in today's presentation, we hope to educate you on many aspects of these facilities. Slide 8. Well, now that I have you all thinking about making money, I'm going to put my regulator hat back on and try to give a bit of a background and better understanding of the bioreactor landfill process. I will be discussing the following questions. What is a bioreactor? How are bioreactor landfills different from leachate recirculation projects? What are some of the critical regulatory understandings and interpretations for bioreactor applications? For example, does Subtitle D even allow leachate addition above approved liner systems? Is there flexibility allowed by research, demonstration, and development regulations for leachate recirculation projects? What are some of the advantages and disadvantages of bioreactor landfill technologies? Also, later on, we will discuss the various phases of waste decomposition, which are critical to understanding the bioreactor landfill process. Slide 9. Later in this presentation, I will get into some of the nuts and bolts associated with the design of bioreactor landfills. Then Mike Kukoc will discuss some of the construction and operational issues, which must be understood in order to have a successful bioreactor project. Finally, Sabette Tolomat will discuss some of the monitoring considerations for the waste itself and the leachate and gas produced by these projects. Let's go to slide 10. One of the goals of the ITRC organization is to gain consensus among the regulators, regulated entities, both public and private, consulting companies, as well as community stakeholders on various key issues associated with a new or emerging technology. I would urge everyone to keep these key findings in the back of their minds during the remainder of the presentation. In the case of bioreactors, we would like everyone to come away with an understanding that bioreactors can be fully permitted facilities, that approved liquids can be added to Subtitle D landfills and that the research demonstration and development regulations allow regulatory flexibility for liquids addition and recirculation on approved liner systems. That wet cell operations where water and other liquids are placed back into the waste pile is a viable alternative to the dry tomb approach, where every effort is made to keep liquids out of the waste. That recirculation of leachate is allowable for increasing the moisture content of the waste. That bioreactor landfills can accelerate waste stabilization. And finally, that bioreactor landfills are operated fundamentally different from Subtitle D landfills, and post-closure care requirements and timeframes may be different for these types of landfills. Slide 11. Let's begin by asking the question, why would anyone want to do a bioreactor project? In other words, why not maintain the status quo with conventional Subtitle D landfills? Well, I think when looking at these two pictures, the answer becomes quite obvious. Shown on this slide are two test cells constructed at the Yolo County Landfill in Davis, California. Both of these test cells were approximately 1/4 acre in size and had waste placed about 40 feet thick. The control cell on the left had waste placed and handled in a Subtitle D fashion, that is to say, minimizing the amount of water infiltrating into the waste. The bioreactor cell on the right had been operated as an anaerobic bioreactor, and approximately 1.14 million gallons of water was added to the cell. It can be clearly seen that the waste had been substantially degraded, as evidenced by the sagging cover. Settlement on the control cell was about 11 inches, whereas settlement on the bioreactor cell was 46 inches in a 2-year time frame. Therefore, the settlement rate at the bioreactor cell was about 4 times faster than the control cell. In less than 4 years, the enhanced cell was settled about 20%. So as you can see, these are pretty dramatic differences. Slide 12. Now let's back up and take a look at existing landfill regulations and discuss how we have evolved to where we are today. The Municipal Solid Waste Landfill Regulations, commonly known as Subtitle D, set forth a basic design premise to basically keep waste as dry as possible. Engineered bottom liner systems, leachate collection systems, and no permeability caps are used to essentially encapsulate waste materials in order to prevent the migration of landfill leachate and gases into their environment. Also, steady continuous addition of liquids into the waste had been discouraged throughout the operating lives of landfills. Liquids addition into the landfill was only possible by way of leachate and gas condensate recirculation as allowed for in the Subtitle D regulations. Slide 13. Now make no mistake about it, there is no question that Subtitle D and its dry tomb approach to waste management is a very effective method of providing a safe repository for waste materials. Since the promulgation of the Subtitle D regulations, traditional Subtitle D landfills had proven themselves to be very effective. However, as far back as the preamble to Subtitle D, the EPA recognized that landfills are, in effect, biological systems that require moisture for decomposition to occur, and that this moisture promotes decomposition of the waste and stabilization of the landfill. Therefore, adding liquids may promote stabilization of the unit. So we are here today to explore alternative methods of managing waste within the boundaries allowed by the current regulations. Slide 14. Here is a picture of a typical Subtitle D landfill, both in operation and construction modes. This particular landfill is located near the coast of South Carolina. As you can see, lots of soil has been used in the operating portion of the landfill, which will eventually be capped. In the area under construction, we can see the impermeable liner system being constructed. As I mentioned before, the landfill is designed and operated to minimize the amount of moisture that is allowed into the landfill. Slide 15. So what makes a bioreactor work, and what makes it different from a Subtitle D landfill? Well, as in the case of all landfills, it takes a lot of hard work. But in the case of a bioreactor landfill, the magic component is water. Lots of water. Remember my bioreactor test cell earlier. 1.14 million gallons of water was used in a test cell 1/4 acre in size. Obviously, water becomes the one key component in making any type of bioreactor work. Slide 16. So how do we get all that water in the landfill within our current regulatory framework? Well, Subtitle D regulations by themselves effectively limit the kinds of liquids that may be added to bioreactor landfills. However, conversely, liquid addition is a key component to the bioreactor landfill. And most large landfills do not generate sufficient volumes of leachate alone necessary to optimize the biodegradation process. As a result, EPA developed and promulgated the Research Demonstration and Development Regulation, commonly known as the RD&D rule. The RD&D rule can be used as a mechanism to allow the permitting of a bioreactor landfill and the injection of the necessary liquids to make it work properly. The federal version of the RD&D rule allows research permits to be issued for 3 years and to be renewed up to 4 times so that the landfill can demonstrate the effectiveness of new technologies such as bioreactor systems. Without this mechanism to allow additional sources of liquids to be added to the landfill, bioreactors would not be optimized to their full potential. As a side note, bear in mind that states may have a different version of the RD&D rule from the federal version, so remember to check with the regulatory body early in the permitting process. Slide 17. Now that we've touched on the subject, what exactly is a bioreactor? Actually, the concept of bioreactors has been around for a while and originates from the systematic treatment of city wastewater in the late 1800s. This concept can be extended to landfills with the so-called treatment of waste materials. With that in mind, several organizations have attempted to develop a definition for bioreactors with the basic concept of accelerated waste decomposition as a common thread. The EPA's Office of Research and Development defines bioreactor as landfills where controlled addition of non-hazardous waste or water accelerate the decomposition of waste generation. And other organizations have developed definitions for bioreactors, and that information can be found in greater detail within the ITRC guidance document. Slide 18. As stated earlier, traditional landfill operations minimize the amount of water allowed to enter the waste during the operational and post-closure care life of a landfill. The bioreactor landfill concept is based on a paradigm shift in which liquids are purposely introduced into the waste. Shown on this slide are several leachate injection lines at a landfill. Although most bioreactor projects to date have been constructed on a pilot scale, we believe the technology is proven and is ready to evolve to full-scale implementation. Slide 19. Often the terms leachate recirculation and bioreactor are used interchangeably. We believe that the two terms are distinctly different and that bioreactors strive to reach and maintain a higher moisture content within the waste than that is attainable by leachate recirculation alone. the process of leachate recirculation can almost be thought of as perhaps as a lighter version of a bioreactor. By placing leachate generated by the facility back into the landfill, we are able to realize many of the same benefits as a full-blown bioreactor. Although the goal of leachate recirculation may not result in an optimal moisture content of the waste, waste degradation is somewhat enhanced. It should be noted that leachate recirculation has been used in the waste industry for some time, and as a result, has gained a measure of acceptability among the regulated community. Slide 20. Given our definitions of what a bioreactor is in the previous slides, there are three main types of bioreactor landfill designs. These are anaerobic, aerobic, and hybrid facilities. In the next few slides, I will briefly go over each bioreactor type. Slide 21. Anaerobic bioreactors are the most common type of bioreactors that are in use today. They use methane-producing microbes, which thrive in oxygen-depleted environments, to degrade organic materials. When moisture content is optimized and oxygen is no longer present in the waste pile, accelerated degradation of waste is possible using this method. As is the case with all bioreactor types, there is a high liquid demand for this process to occur. Methane and carbon dioxide are the two major end products of the anaerobic process. Once the landfill reaches a certain level of maturity, methane production will intensify, and you must plan for it in the design stage, which I will discuss in greater detail later on. Slide 22. Aerobic bioreactors are simply what their name implies. They are facilities that utilize microbes which thrive in an oxygen-rich environment to degrade organic materials. However, not only do you have liquids addition, as is the case with any bioreactor, you also provide oxygen, which is typically handled through the injection of pressurized air into the waste pile. Therefore, additional power is required from the facility to inject air into an aerobic bioreactor, which can be as much as 12 times greater than the power that is required to extract gas from an anaerobic bioreactor of equivalent size. Aerobic bioreactors have the highest rates of degradation, but they also require a high volume of liquids to be added to the waste. As a result of the rapid rate of decomposition during the aerobic process, a significant amount of heat is generated. Carbon dioxide and water are the final products of the aerobic process. Slide 23. Hybrid bioreactors are the final type of bioreactors, and they're not quite as common. The hybrid process uses alternating aerobic and anaerobic conditions within the waste pile to more completely break down waste material than either of these processes alone. These facilities are highly complex in their design, construction, and operation, and they require a significant day-to-day understanding of what is going on inside the landfill. The payoff is in an accelerated waste decomposition and gas generation, as well as a more complete degradation of waste. Let's go to slide 24. So now that we know what bioreactors are, what are some of the advantages to operating a bioreactor-type landfill? Well, by providing the biological microorganism with all the tools necessary to flourish, we can greatly accelerate the decomposition process by allowing the biological stabilization to occur more quickly. The result can be a 20 to 40% increase in landfill space due to enhanced settlement and stabilization of the waste pile. This space can then be reclaimed and additional waste placed back into the reclaimed capacity. The economic benefits to this are obvious. In addition to the secondary benefits, such as fewer landfills, which may be needed to provide necessary capacity. As leachate is reintroduced into the waste pile, there is the benefit of reduced leachate handling and disposal costs for the facility. Increased landfill gas generation occurs in the form of methane. This increased methane generation can be captured and used for energy recovery projects, or the methane can be used as a commodity generating additional cash flow for the facility. Another benefit for bioreactor landfills is the possibility of reducing post-closure care for the facility. For example, as the landfill gas generation curve is accelerated, it is possible that the length of time that the gas has been monitored may be reduced as the gas production at the facility declines. These are just some of the advantages that a bioreactor has over a traditional landfill. Other advantages are discussed in our guidance document. Slide 25. Since landfill gas is such an important issue with bioreactors, let's take a look at how landfill gas production can be evaluated between a subtitle D landfill and a bioreactor landfill. In this graph, we see a hypothetical landfill which accepted 1,000 tons per day of waste and operated for a 20-year time period. The graph in red shows what a landfill gas production curve would look like if the facility were operated as a typical subtitle D landfill. The graph in pink shows what the expected gas production curve would look like if the facility was operated as a bioreactor. We can see that the gas production ramps up very quickly with the bioreactor and peaks at a higher level than a subtitle D landfill. In a bioreactor landfill, gas production is more intense in the short term, but tends to tail off quicker as organic materials are consumed. Also, if we look at the 50-year mark, which will be 20 years of operation and 30 years of post-closure, we can see that gas production has slowed to almost zero at the bioreactor landfill, whereas the typical subtitle D facility is still producing a significant quantity of gas. Slide 26. Well, as you can imagine, with something as complex as a bioreactor landfill, there are some potential disadvantages to be aware of as well. As we saw in a previous slide, there is a need to manage increased volumes of landfill gas early in the landfilling process. The bioreactor process, in effect, supercharges the ability of methane-producing microbes to produce gas. Your gas handling and collection system must be up to the task of handling the gas volume. If your system is not up to the task, migration of gas will become a compliance problem and may result in off-site odors. These facilities are complex, therefore there are increased operations and maintenance requirements. The construction of these facilities is more complex as well. These facilities typically require a higher level of oversight to optimize operation. And there may be additional monitoring requirements, both in numbers of parameters and frequency, particularly for leachate. There will be higher capital costs in the short term, at least until some of the benefits associated with these facilities can be realized. Also, non-uniform settlement may be an issue along with stability issue, particularly along the side slopes. Because we are adding additional volumes of liquids to the waste, there is increased stress on the leachate collection system. The leachate management system must function properly for bioreactors to reach their full potential. Also, additional liquids will be needed for bioreactor landfills to function as designed. The disadvantage to this point is that there may be regulatory resistance to the permitting entity. Finally, with aerobically designed bioreactors, there is an increased risk of fire within the landfill associated with ingesting oxygen into the waste mass. Also, because aerobic bioreactors typically operate at higher temperatures, there may be some additional stress placed on the liner system and collection system due to the elevated temperatures. So as you can see, there are some disadvantages to bioreactors. However, the alternative landfill technologies team believes that all of the disadvantages can be overcome with proper design and operation. Let's go to slide 27. I would now like to quickly run through a series of slides that show the five major phases of decomposition in an anaerobic landfill. These phases occur both in traditional subtitle D landfills and in anaerobic bioreactor landfills. The difference being the amount of time between phases and the time to completion of degradation. More importantly than the actual numbers on these slides is the relationship of the changes that occurred along with the chemistry of the landfill during the various phases. I would like for you to get a basic understanding of the complexity and phase changes that a landfill undergoes during its life. The parameters shown on this graph includes oxygen, nitrate, carbon dioxide, methane, total volatile acids, and chemical oxygen demand. And the graphs show how they change relative to time. Slide 28. Phase 1 is known as the aerobic phase, and is also sometimes referred to as the lag phase. This is the beginning of the decomposition process. During this time, aerobic microbes within the waste begin to consume water that is already in the waste at the time of placement, along with the availability of oxygen. This phase is typically short as available oxygen is exhausted quickly and is the limiting factor. Slide 29. Phase 2 of the process is known as the transition phase, as the predominant bacteria degrading organic matter is switching from aerobic to anaerobic. Oxygen levels within the waste pile will bottom out during this phase. Total volatile acids begin to appear. Slide 30. Phase 3 is known as the acid phase. The pH of the leachate will start to drop as organic matters in the waste are converted to volatile acids. Degradation of organic matter is rapid during this phase, and the lowered pH mobilizes metals and possibly volatile organic compounds within the leachate. As there is no free oxygen in the waste, chemical oxygen demand peaks during this phase. Slide 31. Phase 4 is known as the methanogenic phase. The acid compounds produced in earlier phases are converted to methane and carbon dioxide as microbes consume the acids. The pH will return to a more neutral condition, and the mobility of constituents from the waste starts to decline. In this phase, landfill gas production peaks. Generally, under ideal circumstances, this phase begins about 1 year after the waste placement. Let's go to slide 32. Phase 5 is known as the maturation phase and is the final phase in the process. The beginning of this phase is marked by a significant drop in landfill gas production. The availability of biodegradable matter and nutrients becomes the limiting factor. At this phase, the concentrations of constituents in leachate start to stabilize and continue relatively slow degradation of organic matter continues to occur. A particular note is the fact that several of these phases of degradation may be going on all over the landfill simultaneously, depending on the availability of organic matter, water, oxygen, and nutrients. It is the goal of the bioreactor landfill process to provide microbes with all the materials needed to expedite the five phases of biological degradation. Water is the one factor that can influence the speed at which these processes take place. Hence the reason for liquid addition to these types of landfills at such high levels. Slide 33. So how do we go about operating the landfill to ensure that the various bioreactor functions are indeed optimized? Well, we know water is the one critical controlling factor in allowing this process to occur. So we must increase the moisture content of the waste. This can be done by leachate recirculation or other methods of water and liquid addition. It is generally our goal to accelerate the landfill reaching phase 4 or the methanogenic phase. We want to increase the rate of landfill gas production. The quantity of this natural byproduct of the breakdown process gives us a pretty good indication of how efficiently our bioreactor is working. A side benefit of this, as I mentioned earlier, is that we will be shortening our period of landfill gas production. Finally, after the bioreactor process has run its course, so to speak, the waste materials are stabilized. Slide 34. On this slide, we see the basic thought process for designing and operating a bioreactor landfill. Before we can begin a project such as this, we must collect landfill and bioreactor characterization data. Once this data is evaluated, we can begin to design our bioreactor with reasonable confidence that the process will be successful. The next step is to construct the bioreactor. Construction may be an ongoing process that occurs during the entire life of the facility. After construction comes obviously the operation of the landfill. During operation, we must constantly collect and evaluate data on the performance of the facility. Based on our observations of the facility, we are constantly trying to optimize the performance of the bioreactor for maximum benefit. If the landfill is not operating at optimum, then a redesign of some element of the facility may be in order. This will require looping back up to the construction phase and operating and collecting data to evaluate performance criteria once again. This entire decision-making process is something that should occur on a very routine basis throughout the operating life of the bioreactor facility. Okay, at this point, I would like to discuss the design aspects of bioreactor facilities, beginning on slide 35. Now that I have provided a regulatory overview of bioreactors and landfills, I will be discussing some of the design concepts involving bioreactors. Before doing so, it is important to recognize that a design for a state-of-the-art bioreactor, and all landfills in general, involves a multidisciplinary approach that involves geology, hydrology, civil, geotechnical, and materials engineering. As such, it is beyond the scope of this particular presentation to provide complete information on each and every design aspect of bioreactors. Instead, this presentation will highlight the nuts and bolts of bioreactor design. The ITRC technical guidance document and other reference materials should be consulted for more detailed information. With that in mind, there are basic design parameters that are common to permitting and construction of all landfills, whether the facility proposes to conduct bioreactor operations or not. These design components include liner system, leachate collection, storage, and conveyance systems, landfill gas recovery systems, and so on. In consideration of these components, it is important to recognize that no two bioreactors will be exactly the same. In other words, there's no such thing as a one-size-fits-all design in the case of bioreactors, Because specific design requirements are largely dependent upon the bioreactor infrastructure, state regulatory requirements, local precipitation, and so on. Also, a distinction must be made between new bioreactors and retrofits. Retrofits are essentially existing landfills that have reached interim or final grades, only to begin leachate recirculation. New bioreactors are designed from the subgrade up and will begin recirculation soon after startup operations are initiated. Much of what I will discuss will apply to both types of bioreactors, although the scope of design details may vary somewhat. Slide 36. This slide offers a cross-section view of a bioreactor. Please note that in this case, the only thing that distinguishes a bioreactor from a conventional landfill is the addition of vertical recharge wells and a dual-purpose leachate recirculation and gas collection network. All other components of the bioreactor that you see on the graphic, such as the bottom liner system, as it relates to standard landfill design concepts, are fundamentally the same. Please note that the graphic shows an impermeable cap on the bioreactor. The placement of an impermeable cap is usually postponed or possibly altogether eliminated following successful bioreactor operations. Also, if you look closer at the graphic, you'll see a dual network of gas and leachate recirculation piping systems. We do not encourage the use of dual-purpose piping systems. It is preferred that these systems be dedicated single-use systems. Let's go to slide 37. Now, as I mentioned, certain design parameters are common among conventional landfills and bioreactors, but specific parameters may vary depending on the bioreactor type, that is, aerobic, anaerobic, or hybrid, and the degree of recirculation you want to accomplish. The degrees of recirculation are conventional landfill with no recirculation, limited or sporadic recirculation, moderate recirculation where the moisture content is below optimum levels, and finally, heavy recirculation where the moisture content is kept at or near optimum levels. For example, if one wants to conduct limited recirculation, then gravity infiltration trenches may be appropriate. On the other hand, if the desire is to promote heavy continuous recirculation, one may want to consider multi-leachate delivery system utilizing both vertical and horizontal piping systems. Slide 38. This slide is a simplified graphic that illustrates the degree of recirculation one needs to accomplish at a bioreactor, along with using a permeable cover material to encourage leachate infiltration throughout the waste mass. The degree of recirculation that one wants to achieve throughout the bioreactor will depend on how extensive the leachate recirculation network is, and we'll talk more about this in a few minutes. Slide 39. Some of the major design topics involving bioreactors that I will be covering are geotechnical issues, landfill hydraulics, head-on liner, landfill gas extraction systems, and design optimization objectives. Slide 40. First, let's talk about geotechnical issues. As with all landfills, geotechnical issues are extremely important in bioreactors. I will not be spending a lot of time discussing geotechnical and slope stability issues because these issues are worthy of a separate discussion all by itself. However, the designer should be aware that because bioreactors introduce high volumes of liquid, and in the case of aerobic systems, pressurized air, the fundamental question becomes, will the operation of a bioreactor cause a destabilization of the waste mass from a slope stability perspective? When a designer evaluates a slope stability analysis for a bioreactor landfill, he has to consider the effect that additional liquids will have on the landfill and the accelerated decomposition process that follows. The bottom line is that the addition of significant amounts of liquids for recirculation increases the total weight of the waste mass. Typical values of unit waste for MSW that are commonly employed in conventional landfill range somewhere between 55 and 65 pounds per cubic foot. We are seeing some unit waste in saturated waste zones and bioreactors go as high as 135 pounds per cubic foot, although that is in an extreme case. While an increase in the unit weight of the waste materials have little, if any, effect on the internal stability of frictional material within the landfill, it can, however, reduce the stability of a cohesive material. Also, pore pressures within the bioreactor landfill will increase due to water displacement and gas flow. For example, perched liquids sitting on top of a low permeable layer within the landfill could result in a localized buildup of pore water pressure. Pore pressures tend to be overlooked in conventional slope stability analyses, so they will need to be looked at very carefully, especially in the case of bioreactors. Slide 41. Next up is the subject of landfill hydraulics. Landfill hydraulics is a central topic in bioreactor design and operation, since one is purposely introducing liquids into the waste mass. The amount of precipitation and liquids that travel through the waste mass can be approximated by the use of what is known as Darcy's Law. To design a bioreactor, a water budget analysis can be used to determine the availability of liquids for recirculation and pumping rates. Slide 42. A water budget analysis considers the following site-specific parameters: incoming waste moisture content, hydraulic capacity of the waste, method of liquids distribution, runoff, evapotranspiration, infiltration rates, waste field capacity, and the bolometric capacity of the bioreactor. Now, how do you evaluate these parameters? Let's go to slide 43. Well, one such method is to use the Hydrologic Evaluation of Landfill Performance Model, known as HELP. The HELP model is a quasi two-dimensional hydrologic computer program that evaluates water movement across, into, through, and out of landfills. This model was developed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for the EPA to assist in the evaluation of landfill design alternatives. The model is used to estimate the water balances which would result from different design conditions based upon site-specific parameters. The HELP model can estimate the following: the quantity of leachate permeating through the waste layers in a landfill, the quantity of leachate removed by the leachate collection system, the quantity of leachate leaking through the liner system, which hopefully isn't much, and finally the depth of hydrostatic head on the liner. This model facilitates rapid estimates of the amounts of runoff, evapotranspiration, drainage, leachate collection, and liner leakage rates that can be used to evaluate alternative landfill and bioreactor designs. Specifically, the HELP model can be used as a tool to assist in the design of a leachate collection system for a bioreactor and to estimate the quantity of leachate to be generated under different operational conditions. To achieve this, the HELP model uses three types of input data to estimate hydrologic movement in landfills. The three inputs are climatological data, soil data, and design data. Once we have the HELP model set up for a specific facility, a sensitivity analysis can be performed to evaluate the significance of changes in specific parameters in the efficiency of the leachate collection system. For example, the slope of the liner, the distance between the leachate collection pipes, the depth of drainage layer and the use of geonets are all contributing factors in determining the efficiency of the leachate collection system. Slide 44. This is a graphic that describes the essence of a water balance model, such as the HELP model. We can see the inputs and outputs as it relates to leachate storage. In situ storage of liquids is an important consideration of the water balance model, since it leads to the calculation of leachate generation rates and the design of a leachate recirculation system. In situ storage of liquids in a landfill is possible since the moisture content of the waste received at the gate is below the maximum absorptive capacity of the waste. As you can see by this graphic, the net storage of moisture is defined as the infiltration received, including the amount of recirculation, minus the leachate generation. And the HELP model can evaluate all these factors. Slide 45. Based upon a water balance model for a given bioreactor, leachate injection and collection system can now be designed to handle the projected leachate generation and recirculation rates. Slide 46. Now we're going to talk about the head on liner. Based on regulatory criteria, the head on the liner must be maintained to less than 30 centimeters or 12 inches. For a given leachate collection system layout, the HELP model can estimate the head on the liner. Now, the HELP model is by no means the only way to calculate the head on the liner, but it can provide reasonable estimates as part of the sensitivity analysis that I just mentioned. For example, decreasing the distance between collection pipes and changing the slope can reduce the head on the bottom liner. Also, the leachate collection system should be designed to facilitate the placement of a network of head sensing devices, such as pressure transducers. I should mention, however, that pressure transducers are not always terribly accurate, so that has to be considered in the design. Also, head buildup can result from clogging of the leachate collection system due to settling out of suspended particles from leachate, biological growth, or chemical precipitation, so that also needs to be factored into the design. Slide 47. I am now going to talk about gas systems. It is important to recognize that gas production rates at landfills vary significantly, depending upon the waste types and moisture content of the waste. Gas generation rates are increased since one is volumetrically compressing the gas generation curve over a shorter time frame in the case of bioreactors. And as is the case with leachate, the quality and quantity of landfill gas vary with time. There are a number of gas emission models available to evaluate the quality and quantity of landfill gas. Among these is the EPA gas emissions model, known as LandGEM. This model predicts gas generation flows based upon site-specific information, including waste tonnage placement and inflow, waste types, volumetric capacity, and landfill operating life. The current version of LandGEM is version 3.02, which was released in May 2005. I should mention that the current version is based primarily on conventional landfill scenarios. However, I believe a newer version is currently under development that will consider leachate recirculation scenarios. Now, the gas fencing system must be sized to handle peak gas generation rates during the active bioreactor operation phase. The design of a landfill gas system for a bioreactor begins with the determination of landfill gas flow rates, as modeled, for example, LandGEM. Then, the conceptual design of the gas system proceeds with the determination of head losses, system pressures, and velocities and piping system controlled under vacuum. Computer models are used to determine head losses in the system. One such model that's used for this purpose is called KY gas model, developed by the researchers at the University of Kentucky. This model and other models like it may be used to design any type of piping configuration to coincide with actual field conditions. Slide 48. Now that we've talked about some of the design topics involving bioreactors, I am now going to discuss the design optimization process during the next four slides. This will summarize some of the things we've already talked about. The following are some of the factors that the designer needs to consider in order to optimize bioreactor design. First, you have the volume, composition, waste density, and moisture content of the waste materials, annual precipitation, landfill geometry, including interim height and final elevations, the hydraulic capacity of the leachate recirculation system, recirculation methods. By way of guidance, it would generally take about 1 3/4 inches of leachate and liquids per foot of landfill gas to raise the moisture content of waste at 25% to a moisture content of around 45% at an in-place density of 1,200 pounds per cubic yards. And Mike will be talking more about application rates in greater detail later on. And finally, the placement and type of daily and intermediate cover material. Okay, slide 49. In terms of design optimization, the owner needs to consider the following issues. As I mentioned before, since no two bioreactors are exactly alike, consideration of these issues may be relevant to the facility itself. The intent here is not to provide specific design detail for each bullet one by one, but to give the designer some issues to think about during the design process. These issues are discussed in greater detail in the guidance document. For a new bioreactor, the designer needs to specify the appropriate type of liner system used in the bioreactor based upon the degree of protection needed for local groundwater and compatibility of leachate from the waste that has been generated. The hydraulic capacities of the leachate recirculation and collection removal system must be evaluated. Remember that the goal is to recirculate leachate and make up liquids in order to maintain an elevated moisture content throughout the waste fill. Once you consider designing multi-liquid delivery systems consisting of vertical and horizontal wells to improve recirculation efficiency, the designer must specify techniques to measure the hydrostatic head on the liner system, for example, using appropriate sensors such as pressure transducers. Slide 50. Because recirculation of liquids is imposing additional stresses on the leachate collection system, the long-term performance of the system must be evaluated with regard to the potential for clogging of pipe slots and geotextile fabrics that are commonly used in pipe trenches. One must optimize landfill gas control. This is very important. You don't want to find yourself in a position of generating more landfill gas than the gas collection system can handle, which can result in off-site migration of odors. Otherwise, you may find yourself throttling back liquid recirculation rates until odors are under control. A good design will enable the ability to monitor the effectiveness and uniformity of liquid distribution. The key to successful bioreactor operation is a good monitoring program, which Babette will discuss in greater detail later on. When designing injection wells on a grid pattern, try to keep injection wells away from the slopes in order to minimize side slope seeps, which could cause both instability issues and odors. With regard to slope stability analyses, be very careful in your selection of data for specific waste types and lighting material and their properties. Recognize the fact that the values used for shear strength and other parameters used in a conventional landfill may not be conservative for bioreactor operation at that same landfill. Site 51. Another question that must be answered is, what in place waste densities are most conducive to bioreactor operation and yet maintain economic viability of airspace during the operational phase? In other words, what is the ideal compaction goal? Over-compaction of waste resulting in higher in-place densities may impede leachate recirculation. Low permeability soil should not be used as daily and intermediate cover, which will impede uniform leachate distribution. Consider instead using alternate cover material, and you should consult with the state regulatory agency for specific guidance on alternate cover materials. It may sometimes be necessary to make pH adjustments of leachate. Consider the advantages of waste pre-processing so that the field capacity can be uniform achieved throughout the landfill. However, the cost should be considered against the overall economics of the bioreactor project. The addition of nutrients such as biosolids and sludges to enhance biodegradation may also be considered in the design. And finally, address changes in liquid recirculation rates as stabilization of the waste mass proceeds. Let's go to slide 52. This is a graphic that illustrates some of the things that could go wrong during improper design practices. You can have leachate ponding due to the use of impermeable cover. This can result in side slope seepage of leachate and additional pore pressure. The heterogeneity of waste material can lead to preferential channel, resulting in an uneven distribution of recirculated liquids. As I mentioned before, the stability of the bioreactor can be compromised. Inefficient gas collection due to hydraulic blocking of the system. Gas flow can also be impeded by impermeable cover materials. Slide 53. Okay, at this point I would like to turn the presentation back over to our moderator, Juliana, for questions and answers. Juliana?
Thank you, Mark. We now are going to take a short break for questions. If you're in our simulcast audience, you can send in your question using that orange button, the question mark. It's going to pop up the screen, allow you to type in your question. For our online audience, you are welcome to ask your own questions out loud. Remember to unmute your phone. And if you've used our system, it is *7 to unmute. And please state your name and location when you're asking the question. I'll also point out that if you're using the Cluin system, along the left are a series of slide numbers. So if questions refer to a specific slide number, you can jump to that slide number along the left-hand side. So we have a question from our phone line audience to start. I have a comment from Thibet Tolomat from US EPA, and he's an instructor later in today's training. He wanted to clarify, and Mark, if you want to comment on this, LandGym evaluates gas generation from landfills. Mark had said that earlier, and Thibet wants to clarify that LandGym estimates the volume collected, not generated.
Okay, point well taken. That's correct.
A simulcast question from Damon Howes at ERM in United Kingdom. Is the only advantage of recirculating leachate related to the moisture content of the waste, or does recirculation provide additional cleaning of the leachate?
What was the second part of the question? Leachate recirculation does what to the waste?
Additional cleaning.
That is true. Over time, recirculation of leachate in a landfill essentially has a polishing effect on the leachate itself. So some of the contaminants will be removed during the process. So you actually end up with a better quality of leachate towards the end of the decomposition process.
This is Mike Cusack. Leachate recirculation also is often the cheapest way to handle your leachate, depending on the logistics of your site.
Our question refers to slide 22. From John Lancaster at Earth Tech in Pennsylvania, what temperature range constitutes the high temperatures listed on slide 22?
For aerobic bioreactors, as I mentioned previously, the concern is that such operation can result in higher operating temperature. We feel that somewhere 140, 150 degrees Fahrenheit is the appropriate range in which to conduct aerobic bioreactors. If by chance you're experiencing higher temperature, then the suggestion is to decrease your air injection at that location and to increase leachate recirculation rates. But again, we say we feel that between 140 and 150 is in the appropriate range.
A related question from Britton Luther at Earth Tech in Indiana. What type of temperatures can be expected to be generated? And you may have already answered that. What temperatures can a liner system tolerate?
Well, obviously, and I mentioned that there is potential stress to the liner system as a result of higher temperature. But for a couple projects that I've been working on, in order to take care of that situation, we had the injection and the injection wells for both leachate recirculation and air terminate a good distance above the bottom liner system. 20 or 30 feet is not unheard of. So this way it gives you a little additional measure of comfort. So obviously you don't want things to get too hot close to the bottom liner system.
Do we have questions from our phone line audience? A simulcast question from Roger Watson at the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection in Trenton. He refers to slide 36. On slide 36, why do you advocate dedicated single-use gas and leachate recirculation piping systems?
The reason being is we encourage the use of single-use systems for each gas collection piping and leachate recirculation system, so that you don't get hydraulic blocking. Very often, sometimes in a leachate collection system, you can run into all sorts of problems with condensate filling up, particularly in the air gas collection system. But we prefer a single-use system so that you don't get hydraulic blocking.
Clinton Luther of Earth Tech in Indiana asked, are there considerations of use of catalyst for increasing the temperature and increasing decomposition rates?
Okay, I'm not aware of any catalyst per se for increasing the temperature, but you can help enhance biodegradation rates of the waste material by using biosolids and materials that are very rich in organic materials.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from our phone line audience? I'm currently out of simulcast questions, but we may get some later.
I have one question.
Oh, yes. And you are?
Roger Watson from New Jersey DEP.
Yes.
On slide 51, should the bioreactor operator avoid the use of baled waste because of its very high density?
Okay. Can you repeat the question again, please?
Yeah. In regard to slide 51, you were talking about the ideal compaction goal. We deal a lot with baled waste from transfer stations. Should the bioreactor operator avoid the use of baled waste because of its very high density?
I had not had any direct experience with the use of bale rates in a bioreactor landfill, but your point's well taken. You don't want waste materials to be too compacted because that's going to impede the recirculation of leachate. So, for all intents and purposes, it's probably wise to avoid bale waste.
Okay, thank you.
This is Graham Zimmerman. The other issue with baled waste is that baled waste tends to short circuit the spaces between the bales, tend to short circuit your leachate, so it goes in the top, goes straight to the bottom, and doesn't really permeate through the waste.
That's right.
Thank you, inspectors. We are going to wrap up this question and answer break, and I hope we have time at the end to address more questions. So if you have taken your phone off of mute, please put your phone back on mute. We did pick up some background noise in the later part of the first half, so please double check to be sure that your phone is on mute. If you'd like to use our system to mute, it is *6 to mute your line. And I'll remind you at the next question and answer break, *7 to unmute. If you turn to slide 54, I'm going to now turn over today's presentation to our next instructor. And let me make sure I'm telling you the right slide number. Yes, slide 54. And I'm going to turn the presentation over to Michael Kukuk of Aquaterra Environmental Solutions. Mike?
Thank you, Juliana. Everybody should be on slide 54. And I welcome everybody back after the break. This is Mike Kukuk, and I will now begin my discussion regarding the construction of bioreactors, and we will follow that up with a little longer section on bioreactor operations. What I'm about to discuss over the next few slides applies to all new landfill construction, including bioreactors, serves a generalized overview for all types of landfill construction. One construction aspect of bioreactors that is different from conventional Subtitle D landfills is the increased need for monitoring instrumentation, which will have to be installed during the construction phase. For example, temperature monitoring devices, flow meters, and pressure gauges would be applicable. Let's move to slide 55. Construction phases for a bioreactor typically consist of site preparation, earthwork, trenching, backfilling and compaction, erosion and sediment control, grading, paving, and surfacing, as well as the installation of the bioreactor components, which typically entails your liquid distribution system, your injection system, your monitoring and storage systems for your liquids. Slide 56. The QAQC plan should address all observations and tests during the entire construction phase to ensure that the construction materials and installation procedures satisfy the technical specifications, which are usually provided as an addendum to the design plans. And certainly CQA and CQC are going to be very important, just as they are in any landfill construction project. They'll be a little bit different, but not greatly so. Let's move to slide 57 and talk a little bit about record keeping. Record keeping is important since copies are usually provided as an addendum to the as-built certification documentation that is forwarded to the regulatory agency for approval. The documentation should include inspection reports, which includes daily logs from both the QA and QC inspectors, change orders, and other field documentation, including acceptance forms. The QC inspector or resident engineer should sign off on all laboratory reports and field testing results as they come in on a daily basis. These four slides kind of conclude the construction aspect, even though the operations, we do talk about quite a bit of construction techniques there too. So let's move to slide 58 and move more into the operations section. And this slide is really more of a summary slide of what we're going to be talking about. We'll start off talking about waste filling and compaction techniques. We will spend most of our time on anaerobic bioreactor operations as opposed to aerobic, but we will cover aerobic a little bit at the end. Anaerobic is much more common at this point than aerobic. Within the anaerobic section, we'll talk about goals of an anaerobic bioreactor, application rates, leachate recirculation and liquid addition, as well as some various operational issues. Slide 59. To start off with, let's talk about waste filling. As the waste comes into your site, you want to do things a little bit different than you would at a normal subtotality landfill. First off, if you have the ability to, you want to thin spread the waste where possible, because it's easier to get moisture to a thin layer of waste than there's a thick layer of waste. And we'll talk about that a little bit more here in a few minutes. You want to, if all, at all possible, wet the waste at the working face. And we'll cover this point a few times. That is the easiest place to get to know you're getting good moisture distribution on the waste. Now, it also is a smelly operation, and if it's windy, it can be you're going to have your operators trained in how to do that. But that is the best place to get the liquid to the waste. With a typical bioreactor, you can fill your cells a little bit higher than you would on a normal subtotality landfill. For example, to the top of color elevation, because you know you're going to get sediment. And we'll talk about sediment here a few slides later, but you will get greater sediment so you can fill to a higher elevation and let the waste settle and then go back and reclaim some of that airspace. And finally, fill cells in a circular pattern to allow for an inward gradient. And that is not all that common on all sites, but you do want to try to have an inward gradient to prevent future leachate seeps, because when you're adding liquid, if you have a bioreactor, you're going to have some leachate seeps regardless, but you can minimize those by trying to have an inward gradient on your individual cells. So to slide 60, and continue this topic a little bit. Overcompaction prior to wetting. We talked about we want to place the waste in a thin layer as well as a loose layer. If you overcompact prior to wetting, that will inhibit your ability to distribute moisture throughout the waste mass. Again, it can also contribute to future leachate outbreaks if you have layers of impermeability. So the working phase process that is recommended is to place the trash loose initially, then wet the waste, and then apply your compactive effort. And you will get much denser compaction numbers if the waste is wet. In addition, you want to try to use a permeable daily cover. Or if that's not available to you or it's not permeable in your state and you're having to use clay or shale, you want to remove that impermeable daily cover when you're starting a new lift so you don't have those planes of impermeability within the waste mass. Slide 61, and this is basically a slide we're going to talk specifically more here about anaerobic bioreactor operations. So let's go to 62 and get started with this. We'll start with the benefits of an anaerobic bioreactor. First is airspace recovery. You can expect to get 20% to 40% settlement in the waste mass, and that's basically airspace that you can reclaim. You've already paid to have that liner constructed, but you will be able to get quite a bit more waste in the same airspace by recirculating leachate or adding liquids. You'll be able to accept off-site liquid waste, and most of the sites that are doing that now, that is generally for profit. If you've got liquid waste driving by your site, and you can do a little market research to find that out, that is a great way to bring in the additional liquids that you will need to create a true bioreactor. You will certainly have accelerated gas production, as Mark talked about, and that is, considered a renewable energy source. That is a energy source that can be tapped and captured and sold. We talked about a possible reduction of post-closure care period. Several entities are taking a hard look at that. The Environmental Research and Education Foundation funded a study, and they're kind of a sister organization of ITRC, where they have looked at that, and that is actually an ITRC course now for performance-based systems for post-closure care at MSW landfills. But that basically entails looking at your leachate quality, your groundwater quality, your gas quality, and your final cover quality over time, with the hope that once you stabilize the waste, the 30-year post-closure care period may well be reduced, saving owners significant dollars. And finally, reduce long-term environmental liability. Basically, we're in a bioreactor. Our hope is to stabilize the waste for future generations so we don't have situation where we have a lot of contaminants, leachate, potential items that can affect the environment sitting on a liner that we know at some point is going to break down over time. Let's move to slide 63. Other items here are you want to be able to allow uniform reintroduction of leachate into the fill. And it's easy to say, not always easy to do in the field, and we'll talk about that a little bit, but that is why wetting at the working phase is very important. Because if you don't get it wet there, sometimes you'll have pockets of dryness. Talk a little bit about operational goals. Simpler is better, from what we found out, especially from your operator's standpoint. You don't want to change your operations very much if you can help it. And so the simpler design you have for your leachate recirculation system, your liquid addition system, things go much better from an operational standpoint if you can keep it simple and compatible with your normal landfill operations. You will probably have to do some additional staff training with whatever design you choose for your liquid introduction system. There will be some training for your staff to get up to speed on the new logistics they're going to be following. And finally, cost effective. In general, you don't need a real elaborate, expensive system to get liquids into your waste. And people have kind of found that there's a lot of ways to do it that are not that expensive. And we'll talk a little about that a little bit later. Slide 64. Some anaerobic bioreactor cautions. Leachate alone seldom provides enough moisture to treat all the cells. If you want to get your waste mass up to 40 to 45% moisture, most sites do not create enough leachate to do that, so you're going to have off-site makeup liquids. You certainly have to have a well-designed leachate and gas collection system. That is very important, and you know, most sites have those anyway, but if you're going to be adding moisture and creating gas at a much higher rate, you want to make sure your gas system can handle that so you don't have emission problems. Finally, adding liquids in the winter, especially in the northern states that are cold, will decrease the degradation rate. So during the winter, if you allow your liquids that you're recirculating and putting back in to get cold, that can have a very negative effect on the biological rates within your landfill. So logistically, you just have to be careful of that if you're in a region where your liquids can certainly get below 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Slide 65. Talk a little bit about moisture application rates. Your typical incoming solid waste moisture content is anywhere from 10 to 25%. Now, the goal of the bioreactor is to increase that up to the 40 to 45%. We give an example here at the bottom of this slide. If you want to reach your design moisture content, you're going to need to apply liquid. And a typical range for a liquid need is somewhere between 25 to 75 gallons of liquid per ton, depending on the incoming moisture content of the waste. So to give a simple example, if you have a 1,000 ton per day landfill, at the average of 50 gallons of ton of liquid needed, that's 50,000 gallons per day you will need to bring the waste you get in that day up to 40 to 45%. So it gives you an idea of the type of gallons of moisture or liquid that you will need. And you can look at your leachate you generate every day and compare how much makeup liquid you're going to have to bring in to have a true bioreactor. Slide 66. Talk a little bit about moisture introduction and potential moisture sources. Certainly leachate is the most common one. That's, you know, a lot of sites recirculate all their leachate, and that is the easiest thing to do. Other moisture sources are your gas condensate water, stormwater in the sense of, you know, maybe you're pumping out of a stormwater pond, and some sites are actually designing their cells to try to bring stormwater onto the site in certain areas. So that they can have a free source of additional liquid. Biosolids are a great way to bring in additional bacteria as well as additional moisture into your waste mass. And finally, industrial wastewater, and that is very common. Like I said, that most people that have been able to do that, you can charge for it, and it's another revenue source for you if you can find industrial wastewater that's coming by your site. Slide 67. this slide is a table that talks a little bit about application rates, and the key thing here, probably on the left side, we have cell density in pounds per cubic yard. And you can see at the top is the more dense, 2,000 pounds per cubic yard, going down to a loose 1,200 pounds per cubic yard. On the right side, we're showing how many gallons per day per acre of moisture that you can get in with these different densities. So at 2,000 pounds, where the density is high, you can only get in about 500 gallons per day per acre. At the looser compacted rate, you can get 2,500 to 3,000. So a lot more water can be added to looser waste. So looser waste can take on more moisture is really the point we're trying to make with this slide. And, you know, a lot of times that is counter to how people do it now. You get waste in, you compact it right away. Well, we don't necessarily want to do that. We don't want to compact it until we have been able to get moisture to it. Move to slide 68 and talk a little bit about how to apply. And there's a number of ways to do it. And most of them are fairly simple. Probably the simplest is the first two hills, the surface infiltration pond. Secondly, the surface spraying and spray irrigation. Now, you will need an area that you're not going to be into for a while, because when you do use surface spraying or spray irrigation, that area will be unworkable for some amount of time because it's so wet. It'll be too wet to get into. Thirdly, they're the working phase, which we've already talked about, but that is a key thing. If, you know, you want to be able to try to get liquid introduced at the working phase, if at all possible. And finally, horizontal trenches are best as the landfill is being built, and most bioreactor designs use horizontal trenches, maybe on every 30, 40 feet of waste thickness basis. A lot of sites have used vertical injection wells, and that usually works best with sites, with landfills that you're trying to retrofit, or they're already built and you're trying to retrofit them as a bioreactor, or at least a leachate recirculation site. Let's move to slide 69. We've got a couple pictures here. Surface infiltration on the left. This is a site in south central Kansas, and this site is actually at this point a leachate recirculation site, but this was a large pond that they built on top of their cell one, and there's probably about 30 or 40 feet of waste below this pond. And they were able to take all their leachate, pump it into that pond, and you do get a fair amount of evaporation, but we got a lot of infiltration into that area too, and we're able to do a nice job of getting good moisture distribution over the cell one waste mass. On the bottom right there, spray irrigation. And this is the same site, and this is on their next cell they built, cell two. I mean, it's kind of hard to see there, but those are just basically metal pipes. It tees off there, and we have sprinkler heads we put on top of those pipes. And as opposed to running the leachate into the ponds, you see on the left, we moved it and put it into this spray irrigation system and soaked that area. And but again, as you can see, there's a lot of moisture there. That area was going to be wet for some time, so you want to plan your landfill phasing where you're going to have to give that time to dry out before you can get in and put more waste on top of that area. Go to slide 70, and this shows more of a horizontal trench being constructed. And this is a picture of a trench excavation involving the construction of a horizontal leachate distribution piping system. The point I want to illustrate here is that landfill-related construction work is not a glamorous proposition. The work is often dirty and smelly. Notice the excavated waste materials, the size of the trench. On a hot day, odors can be overwhelming. So if you're putting in a horizontal trenching system and actually having to excavate waste to put it in, you do have to be aware of that, because it is kind of a nasty job, and your operator is not going to be real happy with some of the things if that's what you're doing. So you want to be able to plan out how you're going to do it, how you're going to get your moisture introduced. And there are sometimes simpler ways than this, and many sites use this, and it's just a matter of kind of getting used to it and getting your operations down to where you can do this properly. Move to slide 71 and talk a little bit about some other issues, so number one being the gas management system. And Mark talked about that quite a bit earlier, but you will certainly have increased production of landfill gas. You want to have your gas management system in place prior to commitments of recirculation, and that is basically for odor control and emission control. Because once you start adding liquids, you will create gas very quickly. Talk a little bit about final cover, and it's a little bit different than maybe what you're used to, but you would like to leave your area open without final cover as long as possible. That's to allow for settlement, which you will get over time, because you don't want to build a cap, have it settled 10, 20, 30 feet, be able to reclaim that airspace, but you have to go in and take your cap off to reclaim it. So, and most regulators that we've dealt with have been very open to this. They realize the concept of the bioreactor. They know we're going to get a lot more settlement, so they've allowed us to put an interim cover on so that airspace can go back and be reclaimed once the settlement occurs. Now, a potential drawback with that using an interim cap is you may get slightly less gas control, and you may get higher leachate generation rates. You'll have more precipitation getting into the top of the landfill, but that's not necessarily a bad thing, because the more liquids you can get in, the more degradation you're going to get, the more stabilization. But that is usually an area the regulators have a little bit of concern with, but the sites that I've worked on, at least, that really has not proven to be much of a problem. Lastly, let's talk a little bit about the biological permeable cap, and several people are looking at that. Waste Management has probably been the leader in that at their Louisville bioreactor site, where they're using a zone of compost as opposed to an interim clay cover or shale cover or whatever soils you may have on site. And that compost basically acts as a methane oxidation layer. And they have shown that this could really be very beneficial in reducing your emissions off the top of the landfill. So I think that's probably something a lot more people are going to be looking at as far as for interim caps on bioreactor cells. Let's go to slide 72. And talk a little bit about settlement, and, you know, settlement's a plus because you're getting airspace back, but also you've got the plan, because enhanced settling will certainly probably have an impact on your leachate and gas collection pipes, wells, trenches. So when you design your leachate collection system, you've got to design safety factors in there for the additional settlement that you're going to have, because that certainly will affect wells, pipes, and trenches that you have in place as you build the landfill. Odor is the other probably big concern, because it's going to be worse with the increased waste exposure and the increased moisture. So you want to be able to handle your odor. You're going to have a higher rate of landfill gas generation. And sometimes on some of the sites, the odor is made worse from the addition of biosolids. And depending on your liquid waste stream, some of those can have quite a bit of odor to them. So in general, as an operator, you have to look at your surrounding neighbors, and you have to look at your wind direction, and you've got to look at times of day where you may put these things in, because odor can certainly be a problem, but it's something that can usually always be handled, but you've got to be thinking ahead and planning for it. Because once you have an odor problem, especially if you have neighbors close by, you know that can always be a problem. Let's move to slide 73. But some more operational considerations. If you're looking at a bioreactor, here's some of the things that you're going to have to think about. What will be your sources of liquids? You know, certainly leachate will probably be a source on every site, but you have to look at other potential makeup water sources. Mark talked a little bit about leachate head level maintenance, and that's certainly, you know, 1 foot of the liner is all we can have. So if you're adding a lot of water back into your waste mass, you've got to have a leachate collection system which can handle that flow and maintain less than 1 foot of head on the liner. Leachate outbreaks. If you're going to be recirculating, if you're going to have a bioreactor, you're almost certainly going to have some leachate outbreaks. Now, designing with an inward gradient, using impermeable daily cover, not over-compacting your waste before you get water to it, those things will all help, but you will have some leachate outbreaks. And so you want to be ready for that. I mean, they're fairly easy to fix, but you just want to be prepared that you probably will have some because of all the moisture that you're adding into the landfill. Slope stability. You need to spend some money here and do a good stability analysis, because it is very different than a normal landfill. You've got different pore pressures. You're adding all that liquid in. There's a lot of things from a slope stability standpoint that you want to make sure that you've got covered, so you do not have a side slope failure. Lastly, a gas generation, which we talked about quite a bit. You want to make sure you're prepared to handle that. And winter operations, this is more for the northern states, but if you're in an area that's going to be cold for 4, 5, 6 months of the year, you want to be able to logistically plan for that so your liquids do not get too cold or you don't have lines freezing. Move to slide 74, and we'll talk here for a few slides about aerobic bioreactor operations, which begins on slide 75. A few points we made about aerobic bioreactors. They minimize landfill gas emissions, so you're not going to be necessarily collecting your gas because you don't have that type of gas coming off. But that is also a plus because you don't have to worry about the odors and the gas emissions. Installation, operation, and maintenance on some sites have proven to be cost prohibitive. The aerobic bioreactors have been around for a number of years. Since, like I said earlier, anaerobic is certainly more common. It's easier to do, but there have been some sites where it's just been too expensive to do it. The area of influence of air addition is limited in retrofits because of low permeability, because typical sites have used on-site soils for daily and intermediate cover, and we've had trouble getting air to all the areas of the waste in a retrofit. Numerous pilots have ended with mediocre results, and I think that's probably resulted in a lot of people shying away a little bit and going with the easier anaerobic methodology. However, there are new technology pilot tests that are ongoing where they're using a few different technologies and trying to improve the ability to get air in and actually have an aerobic bioreactor. But it's kind of yet to know if that's going to be successful. Slide 76. There was a question earlier about temperature monitoring and control, and Mark answered that. Yes, typically if you're up over 170, 180, you're going to be in trouble. And temperature monitoring control is certainly very important in an aerobic bioreactor because you can certainly have a landfill fire. When you're adding that air, your temperatures are going to get hot. And so that is probably the most critical aspect is temperature monitoring. Again, similar to an anaerobic, you want to wet the waste at the working phase if possible. You will probably use horizontal piping or vertical wells to get your liquid into the waste mass once your cell is under construction. There are some other design considerations that come into play with an aerobic operation, and one of those is aeration time. And that is highly dependent upon the waste characteristics at your particular site. Food content can have a big impact on that. Certainly the incoming moisture content of the waste will have a big impact, as well as the density, saturation, and permeability of your in-place waste. Those will all affect the amount of time that you'll have to aerate, and you'll probably have to play with that a little bit to get your system down, depending on the characteristics of your specific waste. And with that ends the construction and operations section, and we'll move into the monitoring approach. And with that, I'll hand it over to Tibet.
Thank you very much, Mike. This is rather a short section. A lot of the information that's going to be presented here has already been presented in some form or fashion in the past few sections. But what we're trying to do is identify key parameters to monitor in bioreactor landfills that would enhance operational control and assess environmental impact. Something to remember that most bioreactor landfills or some bioreactor landfills out there are permitted under a research and demonstration permit, which has a certain lifespan. What we're trying to do is provide a template to enable the evaluation of this technology to finalize that rule at some point, hopefully. We try to keep in mind the cost, and we try to use parameters and techniques that are currently available to owner and operators with special emphasis on waste stabilization and leachate management. Slide 78. The monitoring parameters are split into two different sections, the physical parameters and analytical parameters. The physical parameters are geotechnical considerations, urban liner issue, mass and moisture balance, while analytical monitoring parameters are basically byproducts from your landfill, leachate, solids, and gases. Slide 79. I'm not going to dwell on this a lot. There's a lot of experts out there other than me that know more about this than I do. But it has been mentioned before, there needs to be a slope stability study that is conducted in a landfill before you start injecting the leachate into it, and has to take into account the pressure the leachate is putting onto the landfill as well as the gas generation. And some simple stuff like avoiding the toe excavations, avoiding filling its very steep slopes, you know, above 3-to-1, and to allow or reduce the likelihood of having perched water within the landfill, removing any roads or soil that may cause an impermeable barrier and hence instability in the landfill. Slide 80. Head and bladder, of course, is an issue. It's the only regulatory, limit out there for bioactive landfills. Make sure your head and bladder is not to exceed 30 centimeter. So you have, if you're making a fresh design for a new bioactive landfill, just the leachate collection system needs to be designed accordingly. And I think Mark has talked about the HELP model earlier today. Slide 81. Mass balance is particularly important, especially when you're trying to evaluate your settlement. Why one cell settled more or why the cell did not settle as much as you thought it should. You thought you were going to recover 10% of your airspace and you only recovered 4 or 5%. Knowing how much MSW went in there versus how much C&D, if any, went in there. Massive soil, some landfills will take some contaminated soil other than the daily cover that went into that cell. Type of daily cover would give you an idea whether it's, you know, permeable or impermeable. And then finding out what is your landfill volume, either through regular surveys or flyovers. This will give you the volume, will give you compaction, as well as allows you to monitor settlement over time. Slide 82. Moisture balance. It's the bioreactor landfills are called bioreactors. They need to be dealt with accordingly. They are like a big biological and a chemical system. So part of that system is moisture addition. If you're designing a bioreactor to operate at 40% moisture content, you need to make sure that your bioreactor is at 40. It is not at 50, nor is it at 30, so that you can operate it in the best manner possible. Thus, you have to examine the volume of leachate that you're added onto that landfill, the amount of rainfall, the volume of outside liquid added, and then the volume of leachate generated. Now, don't forget the massive sludge added. Sludge, if it has, it is wet, it has a very good amount of liquid that comes along with it. And you also need the wet basis moisture content of that sludge so you can figure out how much water or how much liquid was added to that landfill. Slide 83. We move into the chemical, analytical monitoring parameters. Leachate monitoring is pretty important. It gives you an idea about the behavior of your landfill as a whole. Of course, temperature of the leachate, pH, and conductance are very important. Temperature tells you whether your landfill is actually degrading the solid waste, and temperature should be somewhere at about 37, 35 degrees. The pH indicates whether your landfill is stuck in the acid forming phase or not. In all honesty, I have not seen a bioreactor landfill out there with a pH below 7 or 6.5, but there may be a landfill out there. Total dissolved solids, TDS, is a kind of interesting parameter to take a look at, especially if you're having issues with the potential clogging of the leachate collection system. Same thing with the alkalinity and the chlorides. BOD and COD and TOC, all these three parameters give an indication of that how much degradation occurred in the landfill. BOD to COD ratio is used often to say whether your landfill is actively degrading or has been semi-stabilized. And finally, ammonia. Ammonia is toxic to anaerobic bacteria, to methanogens in particular. So you don't want your ammonia level to accumulate in the leachate too high that it becomes inhibitory to decomposition. I've seen levels, they suggest about 10,000, I think, ppm of ammonia would be inhibitory. I have seen landfills with ammonia levels higher than that, but ammonia is an important parameter to take, keep an eye on. Slide number 84. These are some of the secondary, less important yet, well, I wouldn't say less important. They're a little bit more expensive, but as just about as important as the primary parameters. VOCs, you're adding, especially if you're adding outside liquids that may contain organic contaminants, and, you know, various cleaning out of various tanks, et cetera, VOCs and semi-VOCs would be important to examine in that case. Volatile fatty acids, it's another indication for the pH in your leachate, whether you have acetic or propionic acid. And finally, metals. And again, because you're adding, if you're adding industrial liquids to your landfill, some liquids, ink containing liquids may have an elevated concentration of a particular metal. So making sure that your leachate concentration of these particular metals is not too high to cause a problem is rather important. Slide 85. You can look at the volume of gas generated from a landfill, and you can look at the leachate generated from a landfill, and you can try and say the landfill is stable or the solid waste has degraded. But unless you go in there and grab an actual solid waste sample to prove that all you're doing is looking at secondary influences of the decomposition process. So monitoring of solid waste or solid waste monitoring parameters are rather important to examine. They don't have to be examined on a monthly basis or a weekly basis. They have to be examined mainly on a yearly basis or every 5 years, a longer duration than the leachate and the gas monitoring parameter. What we're talking about here is grabbing a solid sample from you within your landfill and examining the average temperature and the pH and the volatile solid content, which gives you an idea about the decomposition of that waste, and the wet-based moisture content, which gives you an idea on how effective was the moisture delivery system for your landfill. Slide 86. And, of course, gas monitoring is very important, especially nowadays with the climate change and methane being a greenhouse gas. It's examining the total gas flow, how much gas is generated, and then the gas composition gives you an idea on how good the decomposition of the solid waste is progressing. Carbon monoxide is probably a good indicator of a potential fire in the landfill, especially aerobic landfills. Carbon monoxide by itself is not an indicator. However, in conjunction with odors as well as higher temperatures, carbon monoxide is a good indicator of incomplete combustion. And then finally, making sure your wellhead gas composition, both the NESHAP requirements and the fugitive emissions, are reduced and controlled is very important. Slide 87, finally in conclusion, hopefully I have provided you guys with an outline of a monitoring approach that provides practical methods to assess landfill bioreactor operations, and hopefully we will change that in the future as more data is available to the agency to make a final rule on that regulation. And I will turn you guys over to Mark, and thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Tepet. If we go to slide 88, so what have we learned today? Hopefully we have learned that landfill bioreactor technology is a viable way to handle solid waste disposal. Although bioreactor landfill technology is somewhat new, many of the construction and operational issues associated with these types of facilities are not all that different from traditional Subtitle D style landfills. As we have learned today, bioreactor landfills have many advantages over traditional landfills, such as accelerated waste stabilization, increased settlement, and therefore reclaimed airspace, reduced leachate handling and disposal costs, and other factors previously discussed in this presentation. The ITRC Alternative Landfill Technologies team believes that bioreactor landfill technology is ready to move forward the research and development stage and move into an acceptable status for large-scale implementation. We hope that the technical guidance document and this training session provides a good framework for the permitting, designing, constructing, and operating these types of facilities. We encourage each of you to take some time and review the document as it contains much more detail than the basic overview we provided today. And with that, I will hand it back over to Juliana for our final question and answer session. Juliana?
Thank you, Mark. On slide 89, before we get to our questions, let's go to that links to additional resources. So if you select that area of the slide, that's going to take you over to the links page for today's training class. And we've provided the URL on the slide because these links are going to continue to be available as a resource to you. The first link that I'd like to point out is show you how to get to the feedback form. We do look for you to provide feedback before you leave the website today. So if you look to the left on the links page, the third item listed, the feedback, will take you over to the feedback form. And we do appreciate if you take a few minutes to fill out that feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's training class. Looking back to the right, the links are listed. The first link is download today's ITRC training. That allows you to download the presentation for today's training class. In addition to what you've seen on the slides, more information is available in the speaker's notes section of the downloaded version. The next item listed is the document, the ALT-3 document, Technical and Regulatory Guidance for Characterization, Design, Construction, and Monitoring of Bioreactor Landfills. That is the basis of today's training class. And as Mark just said, more information is available in this guidance document, and we do encourage you to download the document itself. In addition, the Alternative Landfill Technology team has developed 4 documents in total, and you can go to the ITRC website and access all of those documents. They're also listed on this links page. In Section 2, we provide some websites that you may find useful. In Section 3, these are links to some of the software and computer models, and some of these we've talked about during today's training class. Section 4 provides a list of documents that you may find useful as you continue to look into this area. And Section 5 and 6 are links to the ITRC website and also to CLUINT, where you can read more about what information is available on those pages. I do now want to take time for questions. So in our phone line audience, remember to unmute your phone, and that's by selecting *7 to unmute. And just state your name, location, and slide number. For our simulcast participants, back on the slides page, the question mark button is what allows you to send in questions. Would someone in our phone line audience like to start with a question? I have a simulcast question. Can municipal wastewater be used to supplement leachate and condensate?
I think it can. There shouldn't be any reason it can't.
I have a question from Mike Zomer at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. He refers to slide 83. Our state has been discouraged monitoring for chemical oxygen demand, COD, by landfills due to the generation of mercury waste in the laboratory during the analysis. Do you feel that COD is indispensable, or do you have any suggestions for alternative test methods to replace this parameter?
They don't have to use the mercury kit. They can use a copper kit. It's available out there. So, yes, COD measurement does produce mercury waste if you use the mercury-specific method. But there are other methods that do not use mercury.
Thank you. I have a comment from the simulcast from Jason Williams at the Virginia DEQ. In the first question and answer, we talked about baled waste. And Jason has some input on that. He says that the bales allow you to fit more waste per truckload. And he shares that at destination landfills, he typically sees that the bales are busted open with an excavator and mixed with other incoming waste. He also mentioned that he only sees whole burial of bales at sites that have an isolated bale fill area.
Mike Kukuk, we have a site in Kansas that we designed and permitted as a bale fill, and they have the baler right on site. All waste that comes in gets baled, and they take them out, and they basically stack them about 3 bales high and put on a small, shallow layer of intermediate cover. They are not a bioreactor, because some of the issues that were said earlier about short-circuiting and the waste being very dense, they are going to start recirculating their leachate, and it'll be interesting to see what type of results we get. But I'm not sure why you would want to tear the bales open. I mean, if you're in a bioreactor, yes, but if you went to the cost to bail the waste, it maybe doesn't seem like economic sense to do that.
Well, this is Jason Williams. I sent in the comment. Typically, the point I was trying to make is the majority of ones that I've seen specifically coming out of New Jersey, which is where the question came from, they do get busted at the working phase because of a management issue. It's not going into a monofill in this situation. It's going in with tipper waste and mixed MSW. So it's easier just to bust them up and blend it into the incoming waste. Unlike the facility you were talking about where you're actually stacking the bales up where that's all that's going in there. And my point was just that the baling allows you to get more on a truck because you can't really pack into the back of a truck typically without doing damage. But once you get to the working phase, if you're going to do a bioreactor, or recirculate leachate, they typically bust them open and spread them out. That was the only point, just trying to respond to the gentleman from New Jersey that asked the question.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Do you have any questions from our phone line audience? From Catherine Geyer at the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, would you suggest having hydrogen sulfide detectors present, especially under anaerobic conditions? In Illinois, we have had problems with hydrogen sulfide odors off-site after periods of heavy rain at a couple Subtitle D landfills.
I guess, yeah. I mean, if you're having hydrogen sulfide issues at a particular landfill, being able to detect the hydrogen sulfide is a good thing. I am familiar with a few sites here in Ohio that are having hydrogen sulfide problems, and that's mainly because of drywall disposal. But having a hydrogen sulfide monitoring capability at the landfill is a good idea.
Yeah, certainly if you're taking gypsum board drywall into the landfill, that is going to be an issue. Most of the sites that I'm familiar with, most of that the material goes to a C&D. You'd really prefer that not to be in a bioreactor. And taking up MSW space, but if you have a site that takes mixed waste, certainly that can be a concern.
A question from Philip Miles at RSK in Romania. Are landfill bioreactors suitable for closed landfills to facilitate increased methane gas generation?
Different marks here, Paul Tom. That really depends on how long the landfill has been closed and what kind of cover system it has on it. I think it really depends on site-specific characteristics that one would need to investigate to entertain the possibility of reopening that landfill and to initiate leachate recirculation. Yeah, essentially, if the landfill has been closed for a while and has an impermeable cap, we can reasonably expect that the waste materials in the dry tomb approach have not sufficiently degraded, so that in some cases it may make sense if the intent is to reclaim airspace or to stabilize waste material to strip off the cap and to initiate leachate recirculation. In fact, a couple of closure projects on the East Coast has done just that.
We also have a couple of sites in the States where it's a Superfund site. It is highly contaminated, and these sites are contaminated because of a landfill, and bioreactor technology is being used at two specific sites for remediation purposes, basically decomposition of organic compounds as well as leachate stabilization.
A question from Britton Luther at EarthTech in Bloomington, Indiana. What are the components of a biological permeable cap?
In general, people have used compost, but if you want something with organics in there that will act as a methane oxidation layer as the gas and methane emit from the landfill. But typically people have used compost because you have an active biological community within the compost.
A question from Ben Seebecker at Shaw E&I in Salem, New Hampshire. On slide 71, you noted a methane oxidation layer associated with a biological permeable cap. Could you please explain the nature and processes involved with this kind of cap and how methane is oxidized?
Typically, what has been used, I've seen one site where that's been used, and Tibet may be able to address this better than me, but it's typically a 2 or 3 foot layer of compost that's put on top of the waste, and the bacteria that are contained within the compost have the ability to oxidize the methane as it slowly seeps through that compost layer. So you're basically using the bugs both in the bioreactor, the waste portion, as well as using the bugs in the compost to oxidize the methane as it slowly emits through the compost layer.
Thank you.
I would like to add to that. I believe the ITRC guidance document on ETCAP, which was also published by the Alternative Landfill Technologies team, I believe it does address this specific issue in greater detail.
If you have a lot of methane available, your methanotroph population will rapidly grow, and that is what ends up oxidizing the methane.
A simulcast question from Roger Watson at the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. On slide 65, do you blend makeup water with leachate to inject into the landfill, or do you inject it as pure water?
You can do it either way. Typically, you're going to be going to some type of a storage container. But it really depends on where your water is coming from. If you're pumping, a simple way is to pump leachate right out of your sump, take a fire hose and bring it up the hill, and that way you're getting your leachate in that way. If you're adding makeup water, that may be coming in through a different pipe or a different system. But again, you can do those to where they're fairly simple. You'll be unload. Say if you have industrial wastewater coming in, the tankers will pull up, they'll unload into a distribution system that is installed within the waste mass.
And also, some facilities also use stormwater runoff that's been collected in the detention ponds. And in that case, they will pipe the water back up into the landfill. But again, you would have to check with the local permitting agency to see if that would be allowable.
Do we have questions from our phone line audience? From Jamie Dyer at Olds College in Alberta, Canada, what do you think the potential is for using a bioreactor process for remediating contaminated soils and contaminated industrial wastewater?
That is a good idea. Of course, it depends on what type of contaminant you have and what the concentrations in question, but I think it's a viable option.
I agree.
So Michael Capo at Gordon Environmental in New Mexico, will ITRC have a future training session on the NESHAP as they apply to bioreactor landfills?
I think that is a good idea. I don't know about the ITRC plans, so I will ask that question, I guess, and see what is the answer. If you can send us an email, we'll be able to reply back.
I'll send that as a follow-up. Do you have any additional questions? I would like to thank everyone for participating today. Thanks to our participants for joining us, and thank you to our instructors for providing this training class. If you have not already, please fill out the feedback form. We do look at that information and appreciate your taking the time to provide feedback to us. For more information about ITRC, you can visit the ITRC website at www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for participating, and have a great day.